Welcome to the America's Jobs Team podcast. Every week, we dive deep with economic development professionals on leadership and other issues challenging our industry. Our goal is to equip listeners with the knowledge to grow their impact and influence. You are America's Jobs Team, and when you get stronger, communities thrive. Hey everyone, it's Faye Davis from Consultant Connect, and I am so glad you're back with us on the America's Jobs Team podcast, which is sponsored by Research on Investment and Gazelle AI. Today, we are bringing you a panel from our virtual conference, Economics. You'll hear from Ron Kitchens as he talks with site consultants Chris Shastock from CBRE and Scott Cooperman from Cooperman Location Solutions about how community politics and media coverage can affect site decisions and how these can hurt your community's chances of landing new projects. It is a super interesting panel, so let's listen in.
You know, our next panel, we're really talking about the politics and the media. And the reason we picked this is I happened to be, I guess, 4 months ago in a site consultant's office, and they were showing me, hey, we're down to three communities, and we have a firm that does Google searches for us on communities and economic development. And we had them do this for us. And look at how negative this community is on business and criticizing the existing companies there. The mayor is criticizing companies. We're just going to eliminate them from it. And it dawned on us, that's not one of those things we talk a lot about, is this impact of politics and in economic development and how persuasive it is. You know, we had a great example, and you can Google it. The CEO of Traeger Grills wrote an op-ed, it's probably 6 weeks ago now, talking about why they left Portland, Oregon, and moved to Utah. And it wasn't for incentives. It wasn't for, you know, better access to their customers. It wasn't better access to materials. It was community culture. You know, and the article begins with, you know, when he announced that the company was going to begin to move some work to Utah, employees set the trucks on fire at the company. So these things matter. The things you read about communities matter. So we wanted to ask Scott Cooperman and Chris Shastock to come in to us and talk about these things and where we are in today's culture. So Chris, Scott, welcome to the economic stage. So you heard my introduction. You know, first thing I'm going to ask is thoughts on the role that politics and the media play in your research and with your clients. Scott, you want to jump in?
Yeah, absolutely. And first thing I want to say is thank you for putting this on the agenda. I think it's an extremely important topic. And I think this is the first time I remember in any kind of discussion forum it coming to light, and, you know, glad to be part of it. I think over the course of this past year, I would say in projects I've been involved with, the amount of uncertainty and atypical things that need to be considered in a site selection decision are at an all-time high. And, you know, in addition to issues related to politics, social injustice, certainly COVID, an election, and climate change have made decision-making more full of anxiety than I've ever seen before. And I'll just share with you to give you an answer. I had one leader that I was working with over the course of the year confide in me that he felt like the eyes of not only his shareholders, but his employees and customers were, you know, kind of in his head and, you know, joining him and his conscience throughout the decision-making process, especially as we narrowed down our locations to a short list. And he was more worried about the, you know, the impact and, you know, and fallout that could play if he felt like he made a decision that went against their corporate brand, their corporate values, and what his employees would think. So an absolute yes to your question, Ron.
I think the key point there, the employees as activist shareholders in the process. Yeah. And that's something we just didn't see a lot of being looked at in the past.
100% agree with that.
Chris, you have thoughts on this?
to not be redundant, I would echo, you know, 100% of everything that Scott just said. I would also add an anecdotal example of a call I had this morning with a client, publicly traded company, made the exact same statement as Scott just shared. And that was, we're staring down the barrel of a board approval for a sizable project. And this individual as a project stakeholder feels, given everything that's gone on in 2020, and quote, the weight of the world and the project, and frankly, the fiduciary as a publicly traded company reporting to the street, sitting squarely on his shoulders. But that said, the fundamentals of our work and the fundamentals of core and sound projects have not changed. And I think the scrutiny has increased and the public nature of decision-making, given the times, has increased, but there's still a lot of deal flow out there and a lot of projects that are looking to hit the ground running.
I think that's awesome to hear. When we look at deals, and we just had Jeff and Mina were just with us at a previous session, and their perspective was market's pretty strong. Things are coming back. It's different. Not going to be on the road as much. What are you seeing as far as where are deals cooked when they get to you? Are companies starting and saying, hey, we got 3 years to figure this out? Or are they starting out with, hey, we've got 6 months and we have to have an announcement because the world may completely change on us and we may not be able to do anything? Where kind of are we at in this recipe? Chris, you want to jump in?
Sure. What I would offer up based on what we've seen the last 9 months, at least since March, so really kind of reflecting on 2020, but now thinking about what 21 is going to look like. Ron, the way I would answer that as a moment in time is the pressure on timing now is related to budget season and budget cycle. So every company is different based on their fiscal or their calendar year when they do budgets. I think the pressure that is really coming on clients now has been, where do I have the capital approval, and in what calendar year or budget was that approved in? How much pressure has that budget gotten? Are we doing restructuring? Can you bury those project costs, frankly, somewhere else? But I think more importantly, if you really think about where we are when those projects come to us, I think we're getting a lot of these at the infancy level and helping to drive them through completion. And that the questions that are being asked by clients are the same. From an industrial standpoint, where the two of us do a lot of work, there has not been a slowdown. If anything, capacity issues have increased. And so the desire and need in order to get product out to a customer or whatever their delivery mechanism is at an all-time high. So I think the speed on a lot of these projects that are, whether it's food or a widget assembly, is moving faster than I've ever seen before, frankly, because consumer demand is so high.
Scott, thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I don't see projects driven, by some of the atypical reasons. I would agree with what Chris said. In the types of companies I work with, I would say a lot of it is driven, the decision-making is driven by a desire to improve margins, decrease transportation costs, decrease occupancy costs. I've also had some situations this year where there was a requirement based on merger and acquisition activity, where suddenly a company had been acquired and had a far greater opportunity and capital support to try and acquire more market share by moving to a different part of the country. So I've seen a little bit of a mixed bag, but I would agree with Chris that when they come to me, they're committed to doing something, and they generally haven't gone too far down the road on their own in terms of where they want to locate. And that's where they want me to start helping them.
Great. So I won't ask you to predict what happens after January 20th or whatever the inauguration date is. But I will ask you, based on what we know, is reshoring real? We've heard a lot about it. We heard a lot about it pre-COVID. Then we heard a lot about it. COVID's going to change markets. Is that something that is real? Or are we just seeing people adapt to changing market conditions?
I'll take a shot at it. I'm going to give you one guy's opinion, And I read and heard, you know, all the stories and opinions on that. I haven't seen too much evidence of it, you know, again, in the realm that I work in. And I think it's largely because offshoring manufacturing and supply chain establishment was done because there was an entity or a company or a cluster outside the U.S. who was able to make something more efficiently with a more specialized focus than somebody else could in the U.S. And an end user here was able to take advantage of that in a cost-effective manner. Moving that and replicating that, because of a pandemic and a supply chain interruption, in short order and bringing that into the U.S. is not easy. There's exceptions to that, but in general, I think that's a lot tougher than people think. So that's just my theory as to why there hasn't been that much of it. And I don't like predicting either, but I don't expect to see a tremendous amount of it.
Chris, you have thoughts on that?
I would say I think in certain industries, yes. You know, the impact to supply chain and specific to COVID and specific to movement of goods, especially coming from Asia, and the delays into ports. Yeah, it's talked about. And is it real? Yeah, I think it's real. But Scott just nailed it. It's like talking about moving a headquarters. It's a costly, costly exercise. So the notion that just overnight or within a 6-month cycle, a company that has relied heavily on product coming into Long Beach, for example, is just going to change and revamp their supply chain. I'm not talking about moving where in the port it comes into, but bringing that all onshore is a costly, complicated exercise to solve for. I do believe and have seen some evidence of it that the notion of made in America, assembled in America, is something that I think some of our manufacturing, production, consumer good clients are starting to talk about a little bit more just because, again, of what's going on globally. Mm-hmm. I think the last 4 years, based on geopolitical theater, has made that a little bit more of a hot button issue. It'll be interesting to see how much it plays out over the next 4 to 8 years. But yeah, it's real. I think you're seeing bigger pushes on it in the life sciences, supply chain arena, or aerospace and defense, whereby companies have taken a look at the components that are going into their product and trying to find a easier or less controversial way to get a product assembled, soup to nuts, and avoid while avoiding tariffs and also being able to look folks in the eye, and say this is an American product, not something that is potentially made elsewhere in the world. But it's going to be talked about the same way that we talked about this a decade ago on the communication, reshoring of call center stuff that was all the rage in 2009, 2010.
Fair enough. If it makes sense financially, it'll happen, but it's not a cultural phenomenon. Unless it's that, truly hunting equipment there, it's going to be pretty hard to sell hunting equipment that doesn't have a Made in America flag on it these days versus, I'm not sure anybody particularly cares where their laptop was built. So I think it depends if it makes sense. Let's talk about the community leadership piece, because we get a lot of feedback at Consultant Connect about, hey, we just got a new, elected body, city council, county, state governor who doesn't get it, doesn't understand economic development, and is making waves. What advice would you give the economic development community in that they should be mentoring elected officials? So I guess what I'm looking to really say is, what are the best do that you see, and how can our communities emulate the best? Scott, you're nodding, so I'm going to pick on you.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Well, first of all, just, before I answer that, I think I've seen evidence, and that there's certainly instances out there where if there's some really, kind of controversial decision making, whether it's legislation that's trying to be enacted or discussed, and it really gets out into the national media, it can easily preclude a region or a community from being considered. So there's negative impact possibilities out there that an economic developer may not even know about. Further down the decision stream, when you get down to a really meaningful shortlist with a client and you're really getting deep into visits, and the visits are undoubtedly going to include discussions, you know, that can get pretty candid with local electeds and, you know, and people in, you know, who they're going to interact with. I always think that those big decisions get made in small moments whereby, you know, companies and the people who are making these decisions are trying to feel good about making a safe decision. And if somebody says something that just doesn't seem like there's an alignment, or, you know, there's going to be a future battle in trying to get a facility operational and stabilized, that's an opportunity for a deal to be lost pretty easily. And I think, you know, making sure that anybody who's going to be involved in economic development outside of the economic development team, whether it's a key utility provider, an elected official, a building official, it's incumbent on those in economic development to do as much coaching as they can, make those people feel part of the process, and, you know, tell them what how the decision is getting made. This is typically a process of elimination, and we're at those stages looking to find reasons to eliminate locations. So, you know, they need to, you know, figure out how best to stay in the running and make those interactions as, you know, sort of conflict-free as possible.
That's awesome. Chris, you have thoughts on that?
You know, the one thing that, if I could chart this out and it'd be the last time we talk about it, it would really be as follows. The impact of non-economic development folks in the economic development process, so elected officials, whether it be that mayors, council members, governors, you name it, they can all play a really impactful component if it is structured. You got the saying, you know, comment, that kind of helpful nudge that can come from an elected official can be very impactful if positioned correctly. So what do I mean by that? I think it's all about communication. The best examples of that are when you, Ron Kitchens, call and say, our governor would like to make a phone call to you or to Scott's client. Do you think your client would be amenable or open to that? Or would that come across as awkward or put them in a tough position? That allows then the entire process to be managed. What doesn't go well is the rogue approach, which is economic development does a great job, and then elected official picks up the phone and starts making phone calls to a client that is completely caught off guard. Mm-hmm. Or frankly, for a Fortune 1000 company that has a pretty defined process in place for corporate communications, PR, messaging, putting a decision maker from an executive leadership team on a spot with a phone call unannounced from an elected official is never going to play well. I know that every economic developer sitting on this right now is nodding and thinking, well, how do I control them? And I don't think it's about control. I think it's all about communication. It is making it crystal clear to Scott's, using Scott's word, everybody has a place in this project. It just needs to be structured and deployed differently based on every single project. So what does that mean? If you've got folks that are in your community that really want to be part of the project, want to be engaged, want to be able to make that phone call, bring that up early. Tell us, share it, even if it seems too early, so that we can start to manage that process and ensure, win or lose, your elected official has an opportunity to have the right conversation at the appropriate time, at the right juncture, that makes everybody look good.
I'm going to add to that real quick. And using Chris's example, when the governor makes that call and, you know, reaches out to, you know, the company considering that location, And he exhibits that he's prepared, has done a little bit of homework, says something about the company, says something that he knows, you know, how the process has gone, and mentions something that's going to make the, you know, the company feel even more confident that he's got his personal support and involvement. That's a way to get it over the top. And I'm sure, as Chris has, I've seen that work firsthand many times.
That's awesome. No, I really appreciate that. Molly Whitehead, asked the question, what various ways do you research a community outside of the data sets that you use? Things like social media, local news outlets, Google, those kind of things. How are you researching the terroir, if you will, of the community?
When I'm there, I make it a point to pick up local newspapers and, you know, read anything that's going on, you know, relative to, you know, sort of political decision making. You know, I said, like you said, you know, Googling, you know, what's going on at the local level with recent council decisions. If we're headed toward a planning and zoning or council session, if possible, I try to, you know, watch by video link if they're publicized, and just get a feel for what the dynamic of a council, you know, discussion might be. But, you know, outside of that, other than, you know, talking to other consultants from time to time who I know may have done work there, you know, a little bit of all the above.
Well, and I think too, and I don't want to sway Chris's answer, but I think too, for knowing both of you, those are some of the questions that you're answering when you're one-on-one with existing companies, because both of you famously want to talk to the existing companies operating in the community to understand not just labor availability and benefits and how, you know, is the EDC going to be here today and gone tomorrow? But those are some of the questions you're asking about how's the community as a host 10 years from now, as opposed to the day the golden shovel goes in the ground. Chris, agree, disagree?
Yeah, yeah. And if that's Molly Whitehead from Boone County, hello, and thank you for your email yesterday. I would say as follows. One of the most beautiful things, if there's a real silver lining for our world on COVID, it has been the emergence of city and county councils on Zoom. So what does that mean? I am, every time we've got a project that's looking at a couple locations that might be getting close to find as, you know, in the 3 to 6 months going in front of council, if I can get access to Zoom or Skype or a video feed or YouTube Live, I watch the council meeting months in advance, because you want to see the dynamics of the council. You want to see the kind of questions that are being asked. You want to see, as they go through their agendas that are public, what are the hot button issues? What matters to folks, whether it's project specific or budget specific, or just how they handle Q&A that comes from the local community. So COVID has put all this much closer to our fingertips, because it's all over the place. You can do it from your kitchen counter. But I would say, you know, I set up Google Alert for every single city, county, and state that we're working in. And I read those daily. Well, you set the time, you can go through them at your own leisure. And it is unbelievable what type of intel you can get on a daily basis that's just being picked up from what's publicized and reported on the internet, to be able to arm yourself appropriately. And to your point, Ron, share it with your client one-on-one as they ask, you know, more intimate questions as to how a city or a county or a state might approach the project they're considering.
Scott, you have something on that?
A follow-up. And I just want to ask Chris, because maybe this is something that the rest of the audience would be interested in. Do you think it's more or less important doing that in a very small community?
Ooh, I like that. I think it's equally as, I'll just go, you know, you and I both sit in the Chicagoland area. I mean, the dysfunction at big city level is equally as the dysfunction you could see at a small town level. I would agree that in a rural, smaller community, sometimes honing in, Scott, is you'll grab more nuggets than you might at a big city tier one level, just based on the volume of projects that may or may not go through. But you know, I would make the argument that doing work in some of the largest cities in this country is significantly sometimes harder just based on the politics of it than you might find at a smaller community. Great, great question, though.
I would agree with you on that.
Awesome. You know, something that's not been in the news a lot, when COVID first announced, we saw a lot of state governors get very proactive and say, hey, we're going to put a hold on all of our expectations of commitments that were made around incentives. Companies that said, we're going to employ, you know, 300 more people this year, all of a sudden COVID hits and everybody's working from home. All of that, I didn't hear any examples around the country of kind of ham-fisted, heavy-handed behaviors by states. But I'm starting to hear now some governors say, well, enough's enough. And you made a commitment. We gave you incentives to do that. Now it's time to stand and deliver, or we want our money back. Do you think that's a trend, that we're going to see more of that? And if so, how do economic developers get ahead of that? And so we don't have kind of mass chaos.
You want to start on that?
you go ahead and take this one first.
Ron, I have not seen, save for maybe one example, a state take the position so dramatically that you just outlined. But I'm not shocked by that in the slightest. I think that's clearly waiting in the wings as tax revenues continue to decline. I mean, this year is almost over, but 2021, you know, isn't magically going to be such a different and wonderful and easy year than 2020 has been. So I wouldn't be shocked at that. I would tell you I've been pleasantly surprised by not the flexibility, but the very early focus by many commerce organizations and strong regional groups that came out and have continued to come out and recognize, based on things like job numbers reported, you know, just today, that there's going to be more wrinkles in compliance, and there are going to be companies that are closing down, you know, sweeping stay-at-home order announced, you know, in California. There's going to be big impacts to headcount and payroll. And I think the reality is any state that would be so aggressive to come out on the other side of that and start saying, we want clawbacks now, there will be a time and a place for that in a recovery. I think that would be a very, very poorly thought out strategy right now, frankly, because many companies have been following the rules of the very states in which they're operating, and thus haven't been able to comply with ramped up headcount and things as simple as the definition of a full-time job. I think that's the big thing, Ron, is you've got states that the definition of a full-time job is an individual that works 35 or 40 hours a week. Well, based on some of the very mandates handed down by that very state, they haven't been able to have people working 35 or 40 hours a week. To come back and say that you're going to do a clawback on that, and I have seen an example of that, is just outrageous. So, you know, let's get through another 12 months of this, get a vaccine hopefully behind us, and hopefully this is all, frankly, a moot point, but that we can see some good flexibility and partnership in the interim to get everybody what they want. And those are successful companies continuing to hire and operate.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Scott.
No, I think Chris nailed it. I think that additional pressure that, you know, to make sure that incentives are, you know, applied with, you know, with more of an eye toward what's going on in the rest of the world is going to be incumbent on state and local government. I'm not surprised to, you know, hear examples like that being out there. I haven't seen much of that on my own projects. But, you know, I also think, you know, for companies that really have a big miss with incentives, even, you know, even before COVID, for reasons that are just based on not living up to their commitments, you know, I try to warn them that, you know, they should expect, you know, pushback from government being, you know, put into play. And I, you know, they generally understand that. And I think you know, I would expect that to continue as well. And I've warned a few of them that it could get even more heavy-handed, you know, because of the, you know, pressures that COVID has brought.
Yep. No, I don't think politics and economic development is going away anytime soon. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Thanks to the economic developer who asked questions. I'm sorry I couldn't get to them all. And again, Scott and Chris, thanks for always being available to meet that match between economic development and site selection. You're both tremendous examples of that.
Thanks, Ron.
You as well.
Take care. Be safe.
You too.
Thanks for sticking with us to the very end. And again, a huge thank you to our sponsors, Research on Investment and Gazelle AI. The America's Jobs Team podcast releases episodes every week that are specifically curated for economic developers like you looking to stay in the know about industry trends, leadership development, career management, growing high-performing organizations, and so much more. So don't forget to subscribe. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Podcasts, or really any other preferred podcast outlet that you use. America's Jobs Team is audio engineered by Joshua Wieters and produced by Faye Davis.